that overnight, and they bring that back to the media. They're very responsive. The commission makes sure that they're responsive. Are we headed for a situation where the local advertising rep working on commission is a dying breed and finally will be shoved out completely from the media business? That's really a scary thought for the efficiency of the system, for the economy as a whole, and for the diversity of an advertiser-supported system. So these are aspects of the advertiser problem that will come to the fore after something is done on June 2nd. And I see we need to focus on that by June 2nd. Take a close look and think about this angle on the whole thing. And I have a feeling that June 2nd is not going to be the end of the process. It's going to be the beginning. Thank you.
Commissioner Adelstein, I understand you have a question for the panel.
Yeah, it's been an excellent panel on the economics of diversity, and I just wanted to get your take on how you use economic models to try to increase the views that are promoted over our airwaves, and including the views of minorities and the ownership by minorities of these outlets. What are, assuming that the FCC may go in the direction of allowing further concentration in terms of ownership, what are some of the creative ways that we can, even within that context, increase our possibility of getting new voices out there? For example, do we need to create more stations? Do we need to have special incentives to allow minorities to be able to own those in terms of Spanish language radio and TV? Do we need to create a separate category for Spanish language as a separate market, as it seems to be from an advertiser's perspective, in order to make sure that we don't allow too much concentration within those distinct types of submarkets so that there can be a diversity of viewpoints within Spanish language as well? Maybe if any of the panelists have a take on that.
Sure, I'll take a stab at it, Commissioner. I think that you've put your finger on a couple of very critical issues. The first thing that's worth pointing out is if these rules go away, it doesn't mean that consolidation may automatically occur. All transactions will still be reviewed, if they reach a reasonable size, by the FCC and certainly by the Justice Department or the Federal Trade Commission. Antitrust law will be brought to bear. Now, it's a very complicated issue how effective antitrust law can be in the mass media space, particularly because of the problem that you brought up. How do you define the markets in which these firms operate? And it may well be that we need to take an aggressive approach to making sure that all separate markets are represented, such that the consolidation that looks benign on a very general and broad market definition may be seen to be causing harm in terms of programming service to particular segments of the audience. And so we do need to pay more attention to different audience segments and to recognize those as valid and important markets, and to use the public policies that remain in a post-regulation environment to ensure that those markets are served. It's a difficult thing to do. It will require a lot of research. It will require, I think, as Michael was pointing out, a reformation of the means by which we measure who is watching what. These are all things that I think the FCC can play a role in helping. I also think there are some broader policies that the FCC could get behind. I would love to see low-power FM radio be brought back from the morgue. That was a decision that I thought was well taken by the Commission, and I very much regret the Congressional evisceration of that, but maybe the place to push back is Congress, and to suggest that along the model of the NEA, some spectrum auction resources are set aside to encourage, endow, seed people who haven't had access to capital traditionally to get into the media business and to say, find your voice, use an outlet that we're providing, and here's some seed resources from this fund to get started. These are the kinds of creative solutions that I think will be necessary going forward.
Do you have any further
Any other panelists wish to respond to that? Or?
I'd like to limit any further responses to just a minute, please. I do want to make sure the public has an opportunity to speak as well.
Well, unfortunately, the industry has pressed through a move to digital television and digital radio that involves only getting these capacities to incumbents and not opening up the opportunity for new players to come in and be licensed. And now, most recently, the commission decided to authorize a format of digital radio that rewards incumbents and does not set aside spectrum for new entry. That's a serious problem. That could be easily addressed in... If spectrum were auctioned in 200 kilohertz increments instead of 6 megahertz increments, you would suddenly have a lot of new radio stations. But that's not being done yet. Maybe it could be done in the future.
Thank you very much. At this point, I'd like to open up the public comments for people that have signed up. I'm going to call up a number of people at a time. I'm going to ask you to please line up by the microphone so that you'll be able to go through fairly quickly. When you hear your name, would you please come and line up? Denise Brady, Alexis Gonzalez, Pamela Drake, Matthew Lassar, Brad Johnson, and Ian Bowl.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Adelstein, for coming to San Francisco to consider public comments from this region, and thank you to the Bay Area's universities for co-sponsoring this event. My name is Denise Brady, and I'm the president of the National Association of Telecommunications Officers and Advisors, NATOA. NATOA is a national association that represents the telecom needs and interests of local governments. Our membership is predominantly composed of local government agencies, staff, and public officials. We also have attorneys and engineers who consult local governments on these issues. Our government members have responsibilities that span cable administration, telecom franchising, rights-of-way management, and IT, including web-based services and government access programming. Since the passage of the 96 Act, NATOA has grappled with scores of important policy issues before the courts, before federal agencies, including the FCC, on Capitol Hill, and a variety of other forums. As a result, we are in the process of expanding our policy platform to more completely reflect the important issues of today, including media ownership. Following is a brief summary of the policy position concerning diversity in media and telecommunications ownership and content. A democratic government is dependent upon an educated and informed population, and an educated and informed population is dependent upon the availability of a wide variety of opinions and viewpoints. The ability to control what is transmitted and what is received is inherent in ownership. Therefore, the concentration of media ownership in a few large companies poses grave danger to the freedom of expression guaranteed by the First Amendment. Commissioner Adelstein, you are in a region of the country that some would say has been devastated by deregulation. We are relying on you to be our advocate on this and every issue before the FCC, as you exercise your charge to regulate communications. Thank you.
Good afternoon, all. I'm Alexis Gonzalez, speaking on behalf of the San Francisco Labor Council, AFL-CIO, representing 80,000 members here in the Greater Bay Area community. We consider ourselves a community, although I understand that perhaps today we're a media market. Cisco Labor Council, the local entity of the AFL-CIO, is proudly, more often than not, the vanguard, very often militant voice of the larger House of Labor. However, I'm pleased to report to you this afternoon that the International Federation, the AFL-CIO, has taken a strong and unambiguous position on the denouncement of increased consolidation of the nation's media, our members' workplaces, and source of information for our working families. The AFL-CIO Department for Professional Employees, which represents organized labor's workers in newspapers, television, radio, and entertainment, and their affiliated communications unions, have warned us that even a relaxation of existing rules, much more so the outright elimination, will exacerbate the trend of large corporate control as conglomerates gobble up smaller independent companies and outlets. Our contract negotiations are, as I know you are aware, then conducted by corporate rather than local representatives, with corporate demands rather than local issues taking precedence. At the same time, consolidation has led to an assault on the jobs in news and entertainment. In the last 3 years, a bit less than 3 years, about 70,000 media workers have been laid off, and radio employment has dropped by 7,000 in 2 years after 20 years of continued growth. Thank you, Commissioner, for coming to San Francisco. Welcome. And I appreciate being in the company of the strong voices that you've heard this afternoon. Thanks.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to make a public comment. My name is Matthew Lasar. I teach United States history at UC Santa Cruz, and I'm the author of a book titled Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network, a study of early listener-supported radio. The early history of commercial radio is replete with the stories of people from relatively humble middle-class entrepreneurial origins starting radio stations. These include restaurant owners, hoteliers, accountants, small manufacturers who wanted to get into the media, expand their local influence, and in some instances, just have some fun. I scanned the web looking at radio license prices today, and I don't see that as much of an option for people without backing from the corporate sector. Even the smallest rural station licenses in many areas go for hyperinflated prices. For example, BuySellRadio.com, in case you're interested, is listing what they call a quote-unquote mom-and-pop station in Pinedale, Wyoming, 80 miles from Jackson Hole. The seller actually boasts the town is, quote, far away from any population center, end of quote. How much does the seller want for this station, whose transmitter power he does not disclose? $50,000 short of $1 million. Then the seller offers this telling and, to my mind, heartbreaking caveat, and I quote, "Time and again I receive requests for more information from people who could not possibly buy a radio station. After spending hours or days getting information together, I will hear, 'Will you take $10,000 down and carry the rest?' The answer is no, so I must ask anyone replying to this ad to explain and disclose their financial situation to me in their initial response, since I simply don't have the time to communicate with the hundreds of people expressing interest in this station who simply don't have the money to buy it. Sure, I might carry half of it, but I need a substantial down payment if I'm going to play banker." I think that this seller's complaint says worlds about the real chances of our nation's moms and pops have of getting into broadcasting. Don't we have an obligation to make electronic media ownership accessible to more than just those who can put $500,000 down on a frequency which the seller boasts is in the middle of nowhere? Do you think that Chairman Powell's media ownership proposals will make the situation better? Worse? Far worse? Ask me something hard. Thank you.
My name is Ian Boll. I teach the history of science and techniques and community studies at the University of California. I'm available virtually at iboll@socrates, you asked for that, .berkeley.edu. That's I-B-O-A-L, B for botulism. I was in such a room before, 7 or 8 years ago in Washington, when we tried to stop this juggernaut, the 1996 Telecommunications Act. What a travesty that was. It's the same beast that confronts us today. It's tempting to say that these proceedings are the second time around a farce. Certainly the public comment period is more or less ridiculous, and itself a symptom of the crisis. The diverse polyphony of our voices reduced to 120 seconds, immensely generous, of course, by the measure of corporate media, reduced to postcards and what the moderator unironically called 2 cents. Quite so. It mimics, it mirrors, in other words, the mediascape of private television and radio. For this reason, I do not address the FCC or other specialists in capitalist regulation, our present commissioner excepted. The FCC are a cause of this disaster, are not a cause of this disaster, it is in itself another symptom. I speak just to those of you in the room and those listening on KPFA and KPOO who intend harm to this system of state-sponsored private tyranny that calls itself free enterprise or the market and even dares call itself democracy. The flourishing of life within this city, this country, and I dare say this planet, now depends on the reappropriation of the commons. And that includes... Thank you. And that includes, because the means of communication and an endless conversation is the condition of possibility of all else, the seizing back of the electromagnetic spectrum. Pake Ben Bagdikian, would you allow me just to finish? Pake Ben Bagdikian, an oligopoly of 20 or 4 or 2 barely makes a difference. Would it make it much worse? I don't know. The whole thing stinks. It is rotten. It is like trying to regulate the slave quarters. Let us take it out for burial. I just want to say this to the commissioner. Please take this news back to the FCC. There are millions of us around the world now who understand the lie of the market. It would better be called the anti-market. One name for our struggle is the anti-globalization movement. Another is the anti-war movement. In our sights are not only the regulations of the FCC, but the whole system. In the words of a poet at an earlier moment of reaction, at the high tide of parliamentary privatization in England, in the wake of another devastating war, and after a police riot on a defenseless citizenry, Shelley said, "We are many, they are few." Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner and Media Alliance, for allowing us to have this public meeting. I'm only sorry the other commissioners couldn't be here. My name is Brad Johnson. I'm a radio engineer from Modesto, California. I'm here today to share with you my experiences with media consolidation. Prior to 96, there were at least a dozen fully staffed radio stations with independent owners in the Modesto market. This allowed for several full-time air personalities, a chief engineer, and many support office staff, each making a living at each and every one of the radio stations. Since Telcom 96, there are only two main corporations who control those dozen radio stations, and the staff of one station, pre-Telcom 96, must now run 5, 6, or 8 stations. Once the larger corporations were allowed to increase the number of radio stations they could legally own and operate from one location, they began consolidating office space and staff. This meant elimination of many full-time jobs, and those who were left on staff were made to work harder and longer without compensation for the increase in responsibilities. People would put in overtime hours to cover the cutbacks in staff, yet they would not be fairly paid for it. You see, after your station was bought by Citadel or Clear Channel, you were likely to be laid off, and because of consolidation, there was less and less options for jobs within the radio industry. Since Clear Channel and other large broadcasters began buying up what were once local and independent radio stations all over the country, it's now hard to find a job in radio without having to work for Cheap Channel. That is, if they had any new job openings. Typically, those new stations that are freshly corporatized employ a salary and a hiring freeze. I'd been working for more than a decade as a radio engineer for a large Modesto station, and also at the same time as an engineer for another group of stations. Then those two companies were both bought by what is now known as Clear Channel. No longer was I working for two companies that competed for my technical services. I found myself working for more hours for less pay. I kept very busy working a few years after the Telcom 96 Act, breaking down longtime local stations and moving them into the corporate building. Maybe everyone else was busy too busy to ask why we built 5 stations in one building without a newsroom. Soon after the construction of the radio station cluster was completed, I was told my job was to be cut to part-time, or Clear Channel would give me a full week of severance pay if I wanted to quit. Then I was illegally terminated over a private email I had written from my home computer regarding illegal activities at Clear Channel, stuff they perpetrate on their own employees, such as a policy against paying overtime as required by state law, equal opportunity employment issues, employing underage children for dangerous antenna tower work, numerous technical as well as OSHA safety violations, and reoccurring sexual harassment in the workplace. In closing, squelching diversification and promoting cookie-cutter radio is not in the public interest. Breaking labor laws and not paying overtime to employees is a criminal behavior. It should also be noted that three people, including two children, were killed in Northern Carolina while working on a 1,500-foot-tall radio tower belonging to WFMX-FM, a Clear Channel station. Please do not consider further consolidation. Please do not consider further consolidation of the media or mandatory digital audio broadcasting. I also believe the Commission should require cable TV providers to carry any and all local broadcasters that provide 3 hours or more a week of local programming.
Mr. Johnson, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I do want to make sure everybody gets a chance to speak. Thank you very much.
I think we're short one panelist. My hometown, Modesto, is an area without any community-minded radio stations. We've been fighting with AT&T and now Comcast Cable, who refuse to allow the Modesto low-power community TV station access to the Modesto cable service. How can any person, town, or city access the airwaves when they are under-regulated, under corporate control, and sold to the highest bidder? Thank you.
Are standing up for the last speaker.
Sir, I'm available for questions regarding Clear Channel and corporate radio at any time. Please feel free to call on me. Thank you.
Thank you. As you know, we have quite a few people waiting to speak, so I'm going to call up the next group of six to the microphone, please. Starting with Nathan Gove, Steve Fine, Rich Herrera, Brian Wilson, Dave Costner, and Willie Ratcliffe.
Thank you. My name is Nathan Gove. I'm a citizen. I drove from Nevada on icy roads just for this meeting. I speak about media, public discourse, and democracy. Michael Powell's response to us is to hide behind legal rulings. A federal court said that some of the ownership rules were, quote, arbitrary and capricious, and sent them back to the FCC. The court didn't say that the rules were wrong. It just wanted better justification. So Powell says he doesn't want to hear anecdotes from activists. He needs scientific evidence to show that ownership rules are publicly necessary. Commissioner, citizens, sometimes persuasive scientific arguments can be made simply. Is there water on the moon? We've looked at it. We've been there. There's no water on the moon except maybe a little ice at the poles. Is there information in the press for citizens to fairly evaluate the so-called free trade area of the Americas, a massive trade agreement on the scale of the European Union, which would affect every American and which is scheduled to be signed and implemented by 2005? No! Most Americans have never even heard of the FTAA. The information isn't there. I know because I've looked. A few articles, maybe, but no real analysis. Regarding this issue of imminent changes in the ownership rules, does the public know this is happening? I speak to a lot of people in Reno, and I've only met one person who knew about the changes before I told them. Is there water on the moon? Yes, but only if you know where to look. Is there substance in our media? A Berkeley journalism professor who is defending our system said you can learn about the truth if you read six newspapers and the foreign press. People who work and aren't obsessive don't have time to do this. Commissioner Adelstein, thank you for coming here today. Even the rules which have been questioned by the courts should stand. The courts merely sought further justification for them. That justification exists. It has been articulated in a 300-page legal brief full of empirical studies published, if memory serves, by the Consumer Union, who publishes Consumer Reports, the Media Alliance, and the Center for Digital Democracy. Thank you.
My name is Stephen Fine. I represent the Media Democracy Task Force of the Social Justice Center of Marin County, just north of here. As TV news drifts into infotainment and ideological propaganda, driving an increasing number of Americans to the Internet, cable companies are pushing for changes in telecommunication rules that may end open, democratic Internet access. Under current FCC rules, dial-up access over telephone lines is considered a telecommunications service, which forces phone companies to provide open access to their telephone wires. However, as the result of cable industry lobbying, the FCC is moving to designate high-speed cable internet connections as an information service rather than a telecommunications service. This change in designation will allow cable companies to control which ISPs, internet service providers, are able to use cable company fiber optic lines to provide internet access. Since cable is a monopoly in most places, choice of ISPs may be restricted to those favored by the cable company, preventing others from entering that market. Customers would even be restricted to only one ISP, could even be restricted to only one ISP, that owned by the cable monopoly. ISPs have, by law, the right to restrict or even block out website content. By controlling the browser software that works over their networks, ISPs have the ability and the authority to give priority to websites they favor or restrict websites with content they don't like. Cable companies already have the technical ability to manage the speed at which different sites come up on monitors, giving them the option of decreasing the opening speeds of sites that have content with which the cable company disagrees and increasing the opening speeds of favored sites. Unregulated cable companies could monitor client website visits, they could censor content and control the information to which their customers have access. We have to prevent this deregulation from eliminating free and open democratic access to the internet, and we have to do it now, because if we don't, the end result will be fascism, and we can't afford that. Thank you.
Commissioner Adelstein, I'm Brian Wilson, the chair of the Alliance for Community Media, a national media advocacy association representing over 1,000 PEG access and community media centers and thousands of cable access channels across this country. Clearly, the vision this country had concerning media in the early part of the 20th century was that one voice or limited voices controlled by large corporations would silence dialogue and create limited access to information and point of view. Market concerns should never be should never impact our citizens' right to a cacophony of voices sharing a wealth of information. The rules currently under review by the FCC are the essential checks and balances to the growing trend in media consolidation. In today's interconnected world, where media is the message, that message is increasingly singular and yet now, more than ever, being regarded by a community as an essential service, whether it be the internet, broadband, broadcast, satellite, or newsprint. The public interest that seems to elude Chairman Powell is best served by the availability of a broadly diverse range of viewpoints, and media diversity is seriously threatened by further consolidation of media ownership. As a democracy, we require a diverse range of media voices and messages in order to fully participate in our collective community. Social and cultural political life. In 1972, the FCC called for space to be reserved for public educational and government or PEG access channels. Changes in the law have significantly weakened the regulatory structure for PEG, but PEG has survived, and it is instructive to take note of the cable model and how it has served people across this country. PEG access is the only media to serve nonprofit organizations with limited budgets and limited resources with training equipment, facilities, and channel space so their mission can be shared. Every month, thousands of locally produced programs are submitted to PEG access for cable cast on non-commercial channels. Literally, that is more local programming than is generated by all of broadcast networks combined. We advocate for this model to be extended throughout the commercial media spectrum. PEG access doesn't involve taxpayer expense or taxpayer involvement. Whether it's public rights of way or public airways, we recommend that legislation require that the industry that profits from the use of public property pay to support